I won't make you give me a show of hands, but I just ask you, who among you knows the story of the prophet Elijah from the book of Kings? Maybe some of you are pretty familiar with it, and for others, it might, excuse me, for others it, I'm not dying, don't worry. Or maybe I am. For others, though, it might be one of those biblical names that you just kind of hear, and it's like, you know, Elijah, Melchizedek, Methuselah, you just sort of pass along a bunch of names that you don't really remember. And Elijah is important in the history of the Old Testament, but also important to understand what's going on in our gospel. Elijah, just to give you a little bit backstory, was a prophet in the northern part of Israel before the Babylonians took all the Israelites into exile. So it's before the year 700 BC, before Christ. And Elijah was a prophet, and he was called by God to prophesy or to challenge those who were worshiping false gods, who were worshiping, in this story, prophets of Baal, who was a false god that they were worshiping in that part of the country. And so God tells Elijah to go out and speak against these to try to change people's hearts. And to do so in this particular story, he was asked to do a sort of prophetic duel. And so you had Elijah, who offered a sacrifice of an animal on an altar. And then you had the prophets of Baal, who were going to also offer a sacrifice. And whichever gods were more powerful, that sacrifice would be consumed in fire on the altar. And so Elijah prepares the sacrifice. And just to kind of, really dig in a little bit, he pours water all over the sacrifice just to show how powerful God would be. And so he does this, and then God comes and consumes this animal in fire. And then the prophets of Baal do the same, and God doesn't show. Their gods don't arrive. They don't do anything. And they try to dance, and they even are like slashing themselves to maybe become a little bit of a sacrifice themselves, and maybe their gods will come and listen, and it's sort of a gory scene, and nothing happens. And so clearly Elijah is shown as the better, the more powerful prophet of the true God. And then he goes and he actually slaughters the 450 prophets Baal. And we can talk about the logic of that perhaps in another homily. But the importance of it for today is that the queen of that area was furious because she worshipped the false gods. And so she threatened to take his life. And so Elijah flees into the wilderness. He's done everything that God has asked him to do, and he's done it with great heroism at the cost of his own life. And so here he is in the wilderness, tired and worn, doing everything that's been asked of him, and he's at basically the end of his rope. And he says literally to God at this point, "Lord, if you could just take my life now." I picture many of us, perhaps, who are living our lives, striving to do the right thing, striving to follow God, can find ourselves, we could say, at the end of our ropes, saying, "What more do you ask of me, God?" You can kind of fill in the blank of your own life. So I think we've all experienced this at some time or another. When I was thinking about this gospel, I was thinking about a trip I went with some friends to Colorado before I started my assignment, and we went hiking. And I went with a father and a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old. And the 11-year-old, like probably anyone his age, was kind of struggling. It's, you know, thousands of feet, and the altitude in the mountains is challenging. And him in particular, maybe he had spent a little bit too much time, you know, playing video games or something, wasn't in as good of shape as he could have been at that moment. And so we're starting the hike, and about 3 minutes in to our hike, he says, "Oh, I think I'm going to be sick." And we're like, "Well," and he's, "let's see it." And he's like, "Oh, I'm going to throw up." And we're like, "Well, all right, do it." And he kind of goes in the woods and, you know, makes a gagging sound and does nothing happens. And they're like, "All right, come on, let's keep going, let's keep going. You're going to be all right." And 5 minutes later, he says, "Oh, my eyes are getting blurry. I think I'm going to pass out." And we're like, "Well, let's see it, pass out, come on. And he doesn't pass out, and you know, we're like every 5 minutes, I mean, it literally was for 3 hours as we're going, something. And it was kind of the same, they're recycling the same things. And we're like, come on, let's go, let's keep going. Kind of pushing him along in this journey. And we're trying to tell him how great the view is going to be, because that's why you go. You know, there's the journey, but you're ultimately trying to get somewhere. And it was this really cool mountain lake. We didn't hike to the summit, but it was to the point where you could look down over what felt like the whole state, and you could felt like you were really close to the top in this crystal clear blue lake like you'd never seen before, not green, you know, like mothy lake or anything here. And it was really neat. And we were trying to say, just hold on, you know, just keep pushing. You can do it. And our strength we're trying to give him, he kept losing that vision, I guess, or our words weren't strong enough. And so every 5 minutes, it was something else. And, you know, we weren't being cruel to him or anything. He had plenty of water and food and all that. And eventually he made it to the top, but, you know, not without some egging on, some pushing. Why do I mention all this? Well, perhaps Elijah is in a similar situation, not that he was, you know, tired after 3 minutes, but he had been really giving everything. And he was at the point where he couldn't perhaps even see the end to which he was pursuing. I mean, perhaps a little bit like this boy that we were hiking with. And yet God does something different with Elijah and something different with us that our gospel speaks about than I could do. You know, I can only encourage. I can say, just keep going. You know, it'll make sense. You'll enjoy it when you get there. And that only goes so far. And God did something different with Elijah. So when Elijah says, take my life, what does the Lord do? He doesn't just say, well, why don't you just push on a little harder, you know? Stop being so weak. You know, he doesn't say that to Elijah. What does he do? He gives him nourishment. He gives him something tangible, something he can hold on to and he can touch along the way. And then he does something that's really interesting, I think. It says that an angel of the Lord came down and touched him. And if you think with a scriptural mindset, anytime you hear angels in the Old or New Testament, you should know that they're fearful beings. It's not like we picture angels, you know, if any of you have any of those precious moment angels. There's nothing frightening about, you know, the precious moment angel that you have. I joked earlier, unless you have about 400 of them in your cabinet, then that might be frightening. But, you know, there's nothing that's kind of frightening about our modern airbrushed image of an angel. But in Scripture, when an angel would come, it was the God who, if you looked upon him, you would die, kind of funneled into a moment and entering into your life. And it would always scare the, you know, living daylights out of someone. And this angel comes and touches him. And it said that he commanded him to get up. In a sense, it's like as though God, instead of just saying, work a little harder, do a little more, be a little more perfect, he comes down into his life and he gives him, in some sense, himself as an encouragement to make it towards that mountain, Mount Horeb. And then what does he do? He gets up, he eats the food, and he carries on in the journey. God doesn't say to him, you know, you've been doing pretty good. Why don't you just forget about the whole prophesying thing. You know, I mean, you've been working pretty hard. Just don't worry about it anymore. God doesn't change his life in that sense. He doesn't get rid of the challenges that he's been given to overcome that are part in the mystery of God, of his plan. He enters into his life and gives him something that allows him to move forward. And that is essentially what we're doing here in each and every Mass, and is at the key to our gospel. Jesus doesn't just come into our life and say, you know, let's just work a little harder, be a little busier, be a little more perfect. I mean, we're challenged to be perfect, don't get me wrong. And if I were to ask people, probably many of us here, what does it mean to be a Christian? And I ask people this, and here's often what I hear. Well, you know, I go to church, and I strive to do the right thing. And that for them is Christianity. And if that's the case, that makes our faith a cruel religion. Why? Because you can never be good enough. Good compared to whom? Everyone else? Compared to someone better than you? Compared to God? I mean, good luck with that. You can never be good enough. You can never work hard enough. And so if Christianity is just working as hard as we possibly can, then I would argue that it is a cruel religion. But that's not what it's about. In the end, God recognizes that we can't do it on our own, no matter who you are, no matter what you have going on in your life. And so what does he do? Well, the first thing he does is he goes to the cross. The God who created the heavens and earth bears all of the suffering and the sickness and the sorrow and the sin of our lives. And he turns it into an avenue for good. And then he comes from the cross into our hearts in this Eucharist. And so Jesus says to them, your ancestors ate manna in the desert, but they died. But I will give you bread that comes down from heaven so that one may eat it and not die. I am the living bread. Like to Elijah, he comes down and touches him, but for us it's even more powerful. Jesus, who bears everything on the cross, then funnels all of that and enters into your heart. And if you receive him in faith, trusting in him, then everything in your life is united to him and then becomes an avenue for good, for God's will. Everything, which to me is the most mind-blowing of all of the aspects of our faith. You know, oftentimes we portion half the things in our life, which would be the good things, or if that's half, sometimes it's more or less, right? And we say that's where God is, and God is in everything that's good and that I like and that's fun, and then everything that's bad that I don't like and my sorrows and my sufferings and even my sin. We say that God is not to be found there. And the cross becoming the Eucharist, entering into our lives, says that not only is it now the good things of your life which are an avenue for God, but also those moments that we reject, those moments of darkness, ultimately even our sin becomes an avenue for God's grace if we give it to him. And we don't have to. You can choose not to. So what do we do with all this? It's like the mountain when we're hiking. You know, I could only say, just wait till you see. It'll be good when you get there. Well, for God, he becomes, you know, the summit of our life is heaven, and he brings the summit down into your heart today in this Mass and in each and every day where you choose him in an act of faith. How awesome is that? And we say, actually, in the theology of our church that the Eucharist is the source and the summit of our faith. You receive the summit of your faith and of your life today in this Mass. This is good news if I've ever heard it before. And so what do? I encourage you, and I feel like this has been my message over the past couple weeks, continue to ask the Lord in faith to enter into your heart as you receive the Eucharist. And he will show up. He will do it if you ask him, if you give him yourself. And so let us do this, and then we can believe that Jesus is the living bread that came down from heaven, and that whoever eats this bread will live forever, because his bread is truly his flesh for the life of the world.